Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, May 24th, 2018. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-some-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for that all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And senior writer Saurabh Amari. Hi, Saurabh.
Hello, John.
So the big news is that Donald Trump has ended the Peace in Our Time North Korea summit in Singapore scheduled for June 12th. And in so doing, basically said, you better not try to test us because we got a lot more nuclear weapons than you. This fantasy idyll that somehow Trump had broken the secret of how to negotiate with foreign powers and was going to, you know, change the whole nature of diplomacy in our time seems to have foundered on the shores of on the rocky shoals of reality. Abe, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, you know, part of everyone really fell hard for the meeting that never happened, the summit that never happened, especially when once you got all the visuals involved of Kim meeting up with the South, and everyone really got like very hopeful and sentimental. And there was also this feeling that
sister of Kim at the
Olympics. Yes, that's right. Yeah, it was a yes. So and
well, that was before the meeting was
right.
Done.
Yeah,
but no, but it was all part of the feeling that something had changed. There had been the sea change.
Yeah, there was a
there was some kind of emotional, spiritual change.
So much theater. Yeah. And I think part of what drove the well, maybe Trump knows what he's doing here was that prior to that. Was this idea that Trump's going to boast us into a conflict? You know, that he's being so reckless that he's having this macho sort of like put down fest on Twitter with Kim, and he's playing with fire. And then, so they when it came about that there was going to be some sort of summit, they sort of said, "Oh, now maybe he knows what he's doing." You know, when in truth. The North Korean leader would always want to have would want to be seen to be a summit partner with the U.S.
Right, because you have the world's 140th,
right? Yeah,
smallest economy, and right. You have the number one economy in the world,
right.
And the most important country, and a country that's only important because it is a threat.
Yeah, I think everybody around this table is the only people who weren't really over the moon for. What we were about to see happening. This thing was fraught from the beginning, probably mismanaged from minute one. The overture came from DPRK, and the president accepted it within the hour of its receipt. There was no legwork. There were no mutually agreed upon objectives. The CIA and the State Department began to do some legwork through Pompeo, making some trips over there in order to get some early overtures, but it wasn't clear that we had any mutually agreed upon objectives. What Kim's focus was on was logistics, where he was going to refuel, what the plane was going to do. There were apparently some concerns over the distance that he was traveling away from DPRK because his internal domestic position is relatively weak, so maybe he was afraid of a coup. He had given up a couple of things, this non-working nuclear test site, which was really not much of a concession at all, and surrendering hostages, which was, well, a concrete gesture in the direction of the United States. Again, not a concrete gesture in the form of anything substantive, because that's why you take hostages, to hold them for ransom and then give them up without giving anything away, really. The whole prospect was probably really fraught, and we're better off that it isn't happening. And now we have to hear about how terrified we should be over the prospect of Kim's deteriorating domestic position, because now he's given up all this, and with exchange without any reciprocity from really the West, we haven't really given him anything. We had a bunch of economic assistance on the table, but it's now not forthcoming. So we have to be afraid over the hardliners to his back. Kim is the negotiating partner that we have in our quest for peace on the peninsula. And to that I say, so what?
Well, look, one major thing you have to say is that we had only one interest in negotiating with the North Korean regime, which was to denuclearize North Korea. We have no other interest. I mean, in theory, I suppose we have the interest of changing the rules on the ground in the Korean Peninsula so that our troops could come home after, you know, 65 years. But that's not, you know, and that's not sort of like a foremost at the top of our agenda. And so there was short of that, no summit could have been a success for us. All it would have been was a kind of regularization of North Korea and the idea that it stood in some fashion at a level comparable to the United States. What's interesting, of course, is that North Korea blew up this summit. It started last week with this notion that they should pull out because we were having military exercises with South Korea. And then it sort of ended with them just hurling insults at Mike Pence last night, which apparently is why Trump pulled out. So,
well, that provided an opportunity for Trump to dig out of this thing, which he started. And frankly, it was a really welcome move and uncharacteristically nimble on his part. Yes. There was a lot of sunk costs on the part of Donald Trump and his the people around him. They were entertaining the prospect of a Nobel Peace Prize. They were really buying their own hype. They had printed out these really silly coins that were commemorating the event. I mean, there was some real high expectations for this thing. So for them to back out of a losing proposition and cut bait, cut their losses, was a real mark of some strategic depth.
Look, who doesn't want a coin? We all want that coin. That coin is the Honus Wagner baseball card of our time. Honus Wagner was an early baseball player who refused to allow his face. They printed some cards, and then he was against smoking, and the cards then didn't come in bubble gum packs but in cigarette packs, and he didn't want himself associated with cigarette smoking, so he refused to allow the card to be printed. There are like 25 of them in existence, and they sell for millions of dollars. Yeah. I don't have millions of dollars. I have some friends who have millions of dollars, and if I were one of them, I bet you one of them is going to figure out a way to get themselves that coin, because that coin is a killer.
It's special, yeah.
It's a total killer. Sohrab, weigh in.
So I was fascinated by the coin, as all of you were, and someone pointed on Twitter that it added an extra chin to Kim Jong-un, who has, you know, his big jowls, but he doesn't have that extra chin where the coin depicted it. So I agree with all of you. I think we called this. I hate to take a to be the one ushering in the collective victory lap, but this was, and as illusory and as dangerous a prospect as President Obama's dealings with Iran, it was framed, oddly enough, as Noah pointed out, by normally sensible Republicans, as there are hardliners and softliners in the Pyongyang regime, and if only we could empower the softliners, the reformers. It was all deja vu all over again. And so, you know, good riddance, because this is not, frankly, it's not how you deal with a regime like. You're not gonna solve that problem with summitry.
We have in history, we really only have a few examples of summits, and they're either failures or abject disasters. I can't really think of a good summit
between adversarial nations. You just qualified it, but there are ones that happen that are pointless, like the various G whatever meetings. It's just
exclusively bilateral summitry between two adversarial powers. And basically, we only have the Soviet Union and the United States. And Vienna was an absolute disaster. And Geneva and Reykjavik were just kind of failures.
And then there was the bizarre breakout of shuttle diplomacy in which you have a negotiation between two warring parties in which the Secretary of State of the United States sort of like travels between them and says, they say this, this one says that, they say this, this one says that. Kissinger did it, John Kerry did it, Warren Christopher did it. The thing about these meetings is that they are, was one of my long-standing things about peace. Peace in the Middle East, peace general. Peace is a condition of the spirit and soul. It is not the end result of a negotiation. So if a nation wants peace and the other nation wants peace, peace is achieved, then the question is, under what terms will the legal relationships between these nations and the things that caused the conflicts, some of the irritants, how do you file them away, or how do you sort of soften them so that the whatever happened, the hostilities can turn into maybe even friendships? That is what peace is. So summits pose the idea that you can talk yourself into peace. And it is a foolish idea. It's never been true, either economically or in militarily or geopolitically, that if a country comes to the summit prepared to make peace, if the Camp David, Sadat and Begin and Carter are at Camp David, they're there successfully because Sadat had already decided that there was going to be peace between Egypt and Israel. And Israel had decided that it was going to take whatever, pretty close to whatever Sadat wanted, because this was such an important thing.
Right. But it was not because of Camp David. Camp David just ratified the geopolitical.
Right.
But by the way, I would go further in that there's an idea among many on the left that not only will the process of summitry convince an adversary to become an ally of some sort, or to get on the same page as you in terms of peace, but that even if they don't, as was the thinking that started to predominate in the Obama administration in the Iran deal, even if Iran doesn't really want peace, if we just get some sort of deal down and they see the benefits of this deal, peace will sort of transpire. There will be a slow but steady shift that will change the thinking in time.
Who are the adversaries to that sort of thinking? The hardliners.
Right, of course. Right.
They have their hardliners, and we have our hardliners.
That's right. I hated
and
that.
And we're allied.
No, but we're back to it. We're back to it because we are being told somehow that whatever positive moves were being made by North Korea seem to have been impeded by the rise of mystical hardliners in the regime to the right of Kim Jong-un. Now, as far as we know, maybe there aren't. I mean, who knows?
Ideological distinctions.
You know, the Paris peace talks, which took place over the course of 3 years during the Vietnam War, the Paris peace talks, I think it was Vernon Walters, who was one of the negotiators, who said that the Vietnamese would happily sit for 6 months negotiating over the shape of the table. Right. So what is that about? That's about the talks being dilatory. Most of the time, people enter these talks because the talks are maybe a way of delaying the inevitable, or they're part of a warrior strategy. Now, I think it's perfectly fair to wonder whether, in the case of North Korea, we can't quite discern what it was that made them start, you know, waving happily toward the South and making these gestures toward the South and starting to make gestures toward us, and what it was that made them pull back, whether the pullback was part of a longer-term strategy. Now, I think there was an idea abroad once we found out that the nuclear test site, the mountain, had collapsed in on itself, that maybe they were in a desperate condition and they were sort of negotiating a Hail Mary because they had nothing else and they didn't have the resources to rebuild the test site. It's hard to look at what happened now and say that may have been true or may not have been true. But, you know, they have their own ideas, and they also have – there is the complication of China sitting there. Everyone in the West has thought that the smart thing to do was empower China to negotiate with North Korea, because they're the only ones who have real leverage against North Korea. And the Chinese were like, we don't know what to do. Well, you know, we can't do anything. What can we do? The one thing that may come out of this as a positive for the United States is if the summit collapses, North Korea is sitting there, we're sitting there, maybe China will rush into the breach. Maybe China will see an opening to enhance its own geostrategic position by serving the world the idea that they have denuclearized North Korea. I don't know.
Well, Kim has been shuttling back and forth between Beijing now for some time in preparation for this meeting, making pretty ostentatious trips in his armored train in order to reinforce sort of the relationship between Beijing and Pyongyang, because it was pretty restrained. They were very frustrated by the idea that there would be a bilateral relationship here, because they treasure their stature in Pyongyang. But I suppose the idea that Kim's position has been weakened here because this was accepted without any game work, and then it was with the rug was pulled out from under him, what have you, and now this is happening even as reporters are gathered today at this very moment at the closing of that meeting, the implosion of these tunnels, and this gesture that he was supposedly giving the United States has been met with a closed fist. That's going to weaken his position in Pyongyang. And to that I say, absolutely great. Why would we care? Why would we care what generals are supposedly going to succeed him in the event of a coup? This is a monarchy. This is a regime that has been handed down father
dynasty.
To son.
Yeah,
it's a dynasty.
Bizarre, semi-mystically religious, sun king,
Emperor of the unknown. Stuff. When it comes to these authoritarian regimes, has typified the diplomatic community's approach to these negotiations. And it inevitably simplifies the situation, I think, to a degree that doesn't do anybody any favors. I mean, we were terrified for most of the life of the Soviet Union of the hardliners who were going to execute a coup and reimpose Stalinism. And when they did, the whole thing went crashing down.
Well, so... one interesting aspect of this is that the aggregate 4 or 5% poll jump that Trump has enjoyed in the last couple of months seems to have coincided with the announcement of the North Korea talks. So one of the things that penetrated outside the hyper-informed bubble in which we live out to people who don't pay that close attention was that, he had dramatically somehow brought the North Koreans to the table, and that this was something that seemed to be an unalloyed good. He got a little bit high marks even from Democrats on his handling of North Korea and all of that. So the question is, how will the American public react to this if they were so excited about the thought of the lowering of tensions and the cessation of hostilities and the possible deal with North Korea? Will it hurt Trump that's no longer on the table?
Well, I'll lay out the why not scenario. I think that it's reasonable for the American people to look at what transpired and say, look, our president did everything possible. He minted a coin.
Back to the coin.
but he was willing to sit down with this monstrous regime, and it was, for all sorts of reasons, it was the Kim regime that ultimately, by its own inner logic, scuttled things and destroyed the prospect of an agreement. So, I don't see why people would say that this was an enormous Trump failure and therefore would punish him on opinion polls.
Because it was actually a failure. I understand that side of it, that he tried and failed.
Right.
So therefore, hey, he's a man of peace.
Right.
But he also, if you read, and not that everyone's going to read the letter that Trump issued, that Trump sent to Kim, canceling the summit. But I mean, he looks foolish, and the letter is foolish and silly, and semi illiterate.
I just don't think you can make the claim that it's good for him when he makes moves toward the North Koreans for peace, and then it's good for him when the summit collapses. Then everything is good for him. If it goes well, it's good for him. If it goes badly, it's good for him. And it's hard for me to imagine. I can see hardline people like us think, well, this is better for him than the alternative. But I don't know that we're really reflective of the general American, now much more disengaged, less, hawkish American population.
Also, we've yet to see how he shapes the aftermath. I mean, if he reverts back to Little Rocket Man tweets and whatnot, that will be, I think, bad for him because no one liked it to begin with. Now it looks especially petulant.
Right. And, well, and could feed into the general sense that after a couple of months of some reasonable either successes or sort of dramatic moves that change the status quo, like the embassy move last week, and then, you know, some stuff we're going to talk about in a minute with Noah about legislative successes, that he's retreating into his, you know, yelling at people on Twitter and going back to culture wars on Twitter as opposed to being more presidential. Obviously, there's other stuff been going on, like the Avenatti Cohen stuff and more Mueller stuff and the spy stuff and all of that. But
and
generally
the Iran
speaking,
deal. I'm not sure the public is totally comfortable with the Iran deal's abrogation.
Right. Okay. So, but I'm just saying, but even there, he is acting at a presidential level. He is abrogating the Iran deal. You know, it's a serious move, and it enhances his stature. Whereas if his summit collapses and then he insults Kim on Twitter, I'm not sure that that enhances his stature and it doesn't reduce him again to the level of a kind of, you know, that the people who love that he yells at people on Twitter will be fine. But those are the people who didn't love that he yelled at people on Twitter are the reason that his poll numbers went from 45% in February of 17 to 32% at the end of December. Those are the retraction of those people from his support base, largely, I think, due to the Twitter culture war, yelling, screaming stuff. If he, you know, if he retreats into it for his comfort level, that should. I mean, maybe you're right, Sarb. You know, things change, and he can also establish that that's his new normal, and that people aren't going to attack him for it.
I think we know this, that had the summit gone forward and they had could claim some illusory garbage achievement, we'd all be screaming about how dangerous and wrongheaded it is, but it would have been extraordinarily popular, and that would have helped him. So at the very least, he's not getting that.
Or had he gone to the summit and left soberly and said,
yeah,
we sat down,
which is what I thought.
We made our offer. They countered. They will not give up their nuclear weapons. I cannot, in good conscience, make a deal with them. We tried. We tried, and it's on them that it failed. I think that would have been better. We've been talking here about what happened after the Reykjavik summit. Now, that's obviously a totally different thing between Reagan and Gorbachev in 1985, when the possible total elimination of nuclear weapons from the face of the earth was on the table, in theory.
100. We would have agreed to 100 each.
Well,
Britain and France would not have been a part of that agreement.
Okay, but anyway, there were the process, the conceptual framework that Gorbachev was tempting Reagan with was, let's get rid of our nuclear weapons. And finally, and at the end, Reagan said, I cannot do this. Now, Gorbachev really only did it because he knew that SDI was coming. And then as they left Reykjavik, George Shultz, the Secretary of State, said, because it was viewed as a failure, although they said, well, we have some new cultural contacts, and it wasn't a failure from our perspective, because one of the cultural contexts was Reagan going to Moscow, which he did in 1987, and then he made this extraordinary speech at Moscow State University that was a key moment in helping revivify or a democracy movement that helped bring down the Soviet Union 4 years later. But as they left, it was thought to have been a great depressing failure, that they came up with no new changes in the nuclear relationship. And George Shultz, pestered by reporters on the plane, said, you misunderstand. I have never been prouder of my president. That he was in terror, that because Gorbachev and Reagan were alone at some point, and that was when Gorbachev sprung this on Reagan. And I don't think that hurt Reagan. And I think a serious summit negotiation that ends in an American president, even one who is as controversial and unpopular with so many people as Trump, saying, I could not in good conscience make a deal, is better than saying, I can't even go to the summit with them, which is what he should have thought in the first place, mm-hmm. shall we say.
I'm not, I mean, yeah, maybe. I'm not sure. The impulse, the Schultz statement, which I'm reading here, which includes that I have never been so proud of my president as I have been in the sessions, and particularly this afternoon, leads immediately into this enumeration of all the things they achieved at the summit. Which is always the impulse. The impulse is to say that this wasn't a failure. But we did all this other stuff.
That wasn't in Reykjavik, but I was there, and I tell you that the general perception was that the summit was a failure because they had not come to any. Now, by the way, not a failure if you were a neocon hawk who believed that any deal with the Soviet Union was a deal with the devil. So. That was a different set of circumstances. So for some of us, we were celebratory about it, but that was not the general mainstream feeling, let's say.
I mean, yeah, the impulse here is to take advantage, I think, of America's allies, which seems to be what presidents do these days. The extent to which the only real loser here is the President Moon in South Korea, who has been jerked around. Who was shocked by this summit, who was not informed of its cancellation, whose job approval rating is sky high because he is being seen as executing the sunshine policy that has been basically the regime or the presidency's policy since it was a democratic regime, not a military dictatorship. And, what's going to happen to his domestic position is really the most concerning thing, I think, from a perspective of anybody who values that relationship. But beyond that, I don't see anything bad.
He's it was even by the standards of the Sunshine Policy, he's a...
squish.
He's a squish.
He's a terrible squish. He sold himself. Remember, he is the follow-on to a totally discredited, corrupt presidency, and he kind of ran a sunshine and rainbows thing about how he would come in and he would be nicer and they would make a nicer deal with North Korea, and I'm not sure that that's
we don't need another Justin Trudeau on the world stage.
Well, if he's that's really not fair, but I would just say keep your powder dry on any South Korean leader, because it's not the record of wholehearted.
It is valuable for us to be able to present the South Korean presidency as the face of negotiations with North Korea at times. Not usually. I'm generally not in favor of bilateral relationships with North Korea.
South Korea is an important country in the world. It's a vibrant, democratic country with a lot of corrupt politicians, and it's an important ally of ours. I'm just saying that I don't know. Moon is an unknown quantity, and I don't know that we should be crying for him. Like, let him. He was also somebody whose efforts advanced this new image of the North Korean state as being something that you could deal with.
I'm very curious to see what happens in terms of the Trump administration's posture towards North Korea going forward. Because if you take in the totality of the way that Trump has acted towards North Korea, it's a very bizarre course. I mean, there was all the name calling and the little rocket man
fire and fury, both the name calling and the real threat, like, you come anywhere near us and we will destroy you.
And basically, then there was the very strange way that North Korea was handled during Trump's State of the Union, where he went on a long indictment of North Korea, and particularly of its human rights violations and championing dissenters and those who were abused by the regime.
Well, he had that.
That's
in
right.
In the gallery, he paid tribute to this North Korean defector who had been maimed by the regime.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then I think somewhat ominously never announced an actual policy, just sort of left it there at that. And then there's this explosion of peace talks and all the flowers and rainbows that we have been witnessing over these last months. I don't know where this is going. I mean, it's a really kind of a bizarre series of takes.
This is an improvisatory presidency. Yeah. I mean, every time you want to impose, like our friend Walter Russell Mead, who's someone I respect greatly, is attempting to construct a superstructure for Trump's foreign policy that brings in China, the economic things, trade, and how he's reacting to North Korea. Matt Continetti, who writes for us, you know, is saying that Trump's great strength is a strategic ambiguity that is enhanced rather than hurt by the current pullout from the summit. But, you know, I think Trump reacts to things in real time and decides that, you know, he's not throwing good money after bad, or he's not going to do X, or he's not going to do Y, and doesn't think about how it fits into an overall
framework. It's not as theoretical as theoretical-minded people would like to believe.
Yeah, so Todd Lindbergh, who's my oldest and closest friend, had a piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday in which he said Trump had to abrogate the Iran deal in order to go ahead with any kind of negotiation with North Korea. Well, maybe. He thinks so, and it makes sense that you would say that, you know, Kim couldn't come to the table saying, I need as much as Iran has, or maybe not. You know, I see no reason to believe that Trump would necessarily connect the two. And just because I wish that one could impose this kind of clarity, but I just think it's more our desperate wish to have a clear foreign policy than that there is a clear foreign policy. Excuse me. Noah, you had a great post the other day.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Called Politics Not Paranoia. Why don't you tell everybody what your central thesis is while I try not to cough?
Sure. So yesterday there was a little bit of legislative activity in Congress. We passed a reform bill that would roll back a substantial amount of regulations in the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act of 2009-2010. And they passed in the House, with a resounding bipartisan margin, a prison reform bill. Which faces a little rocky future because it doesn't go far enough, really, for Republicans in the Senate who want to see sentencing reform as well as some prison reform, some amenities and what have you, and some extension of privileges to inmates. And the thesis, essentially, was that this is the result of years of labor, of making a case, of pursuing incremental policy solutions to this, and doing so in a very concerted way that didn't overmatch expectations with what you can see on the ground, and didn't abandon the political process as though it were a naive and worthless pursuit. And for example, the regulations that we pursued on Dodd-Frank, rolling back Dodd-Frank, really just lifts a lot of restrictions on banks with less than $50 billion in assets. Which were the small community banks, which were really forced out of the marketplace by Dodd-Frank, which imposed a lot of regulations on certain banks. And the only banks that could really absorb these costs were the mega banks, the J.P. Morgan Chases, your Banks of America, the things that were supposedly too big to fail. Dodd-Frank made those banks bigger. Republicans have been making that argument for a decade, and yesterday they won the argument. And the progressive response has been to allege a vast conspiracy has been ongoing here that has finally flowered, that these special interests working behind closed doors and paying off legislatures finally got what they were paying for. This is what Senator Elizabeth Warren said, and that's paranoia. It's not politics. Similarly, Republicans who might be frustrated by the prison reform effort would be shocked to see Donald Trump, you know, the law and order president, the new law and order president, consenting to all this, because these arguments have been made for years and they finally were won. And it's sort of what I got at the cover piece in last month's issue, which is the fatalist conceit, which undervalues the political process in favor of these self-serving conspiratorial narratives about how the political process doesn't work when it absolutely does. It just takes a lot of work. And nobody wants to do all that work. They want to see their objectives materialize overnight. And yet we're not really seeing a lot of celebration from Republicans. Republicans have a lot to celebrate.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Paul Ryan is trying to celebrate it.
Yes, he is.
Paul Ryan gave a press conference in which he tried to tout these matters. But the person who makes it impossible for Republicans to celebrate is Trump.
Well, let's list off what they have to celebrate right now.
Before we do that, all I want to say is this, which is that there is this movement. You're saying they you know, sort of cracked the ice and are getting, bipartisan movement, which is kind of startling. in some of these areas.
Yeah, Dodd-Frank, by the way, was bipartisan in the House, and a two-thirds majority in the Senate approved these measures.
Right. So the question is, what narrative does Trump want? And ordinarily, a president would want to rush to the microphones and say, we are getting things done in Washington. We are upending the, you know, no, can't get anything done, you know, ineffectual, you know, hidebound, landlocked Congress, and things are changing, and good things are happening for prisoners, for small local country bankers like, you know, It's a like George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life, for all of that. And Trump isn't doing that because it's not the narrative that Trump wants. Trump is not comfortable with the positive narrative. That's what's interesting.
They could be talking about not just Dodd-Frank's rollback, but a bill that reforms the VA, which also passed Congress, legislation that allows terminally ill patients to try medications that have not had FDA approval,
right to try, it's called.
The White House did, obviously, the Iran deal and moved the Jerusalem embassy, and then they effected these changes to Title IX, which essentially strip public funding from organizations that advocate abortions. You know, that's sort of a simplification of the measure, but it is in effect what that rule will do. And the White House actually sent out communications talking points on Monday to its allies saying, you know, push this thing really hard because it's a big risk for us and it's a big conservative victory. And what do conservatives want to talk about? They want to talk about the NFL. And how
the
football players should be deported.
The NFL. This is where you're being unfit.
No. I don't think so. And I would add the spy thing that we talked about on Monday to this list of grievances. I think the conservative media market is pushing these issues.
But they
and
are
Trump
following,
is following them, not the other way around.
They are following the president. If the president went up in front of a microphone and said, this is what you're not being told by the liberal media. What you're not being told by the liberal media is that Trump and the Republicans and Democrats on the Hill are finding common ground. We are getting things done. We are changing. For 5 years or for 6 years, nothing got done in Washington under Obama. He was unable to make any kind of move. We've made, you know, we in Congress, Democrats are coming toward Republicans and agreeing to certain things. And this is a real change. And it's great. And, you know, when you're thinking ahead to voting in November 2018, think about how we're getting legislation passed and nothing ever got passed. But that's not what he wants to talk about. He's going on Fox and Friends this morning and saying that football players who don't stand for the anthem shouldn't be in this country. That's Trump. He could be talking about all sorts of things.
After winning a major victory from the NFL, by the way, which basically said they would fine players substantially and teams if they engaged in that kind of protest. He won. What is he doing? He's moving the goalposts even further to have this battle, to keep this battle alive.
He did tout the Title IX order, essentially, that bars
Title 10.
Title 10. Sorry. He did tout that at the Susan B. Anthony dinner, I think, last night or a couple of nights ago.
Okay, but that's not the same thing that I'm talking about, because that is not a bipartisan
consensus move. Sure,
that was a unilateral executive action meant to shore up and please his base. I'm talking about saying
prison reform,
Dodd-Frank. I don't care what Elizabeth Warren says. They got
259, I think it was,
yeah,
in the
so
House.
Yeah, so they got 20,
and
they got 20 Democrats in
the
House,
Senate.
And they got another 17 or 18 senators, Democratic senators, to vote for this. We haven't seen this. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen this happen.
A long time.
I don't remember when.
I mean, this is
Tip
a key. This is a when this was passed in 2010, this was a big deal. This was a moment of celebration for progressives and Democrats, because it was the first legislative achievement that addressed what they said were the causes of the 2008 financial collapse.
And you know what? It is a perfect Trumpian theme where he can say, because of these complex regulations, and I know so many people in business, small business especially, where they have made it, first of all, very difficult for small business to get loans, and it has choked off a lot of small banks that are the Main Street banks. The only people who can afford to deal with the mountains of paperwork that under Dodd-Frank is generated by each transaction are the big guys.
Right.
So
really, this is a totally unintended consequence. The classic unintended consequence of large-scale legislate was not intended by liberals that what you would do is empower larger institutions and cement their centrality, as opposed to smaller scale institutions. But that's what happened, because the unintended consequences of gigantic pieces of legislation, you learn after the fact. People warned that it might happen, but it did happen, and it happened enough that, you know, more than a third of the Democratic caucus in the Senate voted to relax these rules.
So this would be a perfect
But it's not the perfect Trumpian theme.
No, because he can say, look.
It's the Trumpian theme you want. You want him to be the deregulatory president.
Not necessarily.
He wants to be the Colin Kaepernick president.
But he can say, look, I broke the unholy alliance
And here's what's so crazy. Couldn't he be both? Couldn't he? I mean, one assumes he wastes enough time during the course of a day that he could tout the achievement and then go on his deportation rant.
No, as a substantive matter, I find it repugnant that he throws out comments all the time where he says, well, if you don't want to stand for the flag, you better not be in the country. And he did it minutes after he was talking about MS-13, who are genuinely, you know, I don't use animals because they're humans, but they're evil, vile human beings. You know, football players who don't kneel, who don't stand for the national anthem are not comparable to MS-13. So I think substantively what he said and the way he tied them, whether consciously or not, was repulsive. But I do think he can drive the cultural point, because every time it's put as a blank cultural test to the left, they fail. Right, like they don't just say yes, football players should stand. It's our national anthem. Whatever our disagreements about policy, we should stand for the anthem. Thousands of brave young men and women have died for that flag and that anthem. So stand up for it, and then you can protest before or after. I think that's fine. The left is totally unable to say.
This is why conservatives should have been a lot more skeptical of the animals comment, even though it really resonated all over the place and everybody loved it, because civic propriety and what the guy says at the bar are almost always antithetical, and why we should expect more from our presidents, because it doesn't stop there. And when we start going down these roads and start normalizing, I hate to use that term, normalizing these outlooks on certain people and certain things. It's not healthy.
I hate to be like, in the heartland or the mainland, whatever. The idea that MS-13 is unequivocally evil, and that everyone should come out and just say whatever words you want to use to denounce them, you should, and that you should stand for the flag. Those are supremely kind of popular, unimpeachable.
Of course, position. Because the threat they pose is minimal. It basically doesn't exist. The last murder confirmed by an MS-13 member was in April of 2017.
Okay. However, let's move on.
These are stand-ins for cultural.
Right. I mean, there's an interest. Well, they're partially, but they are brutal. And like in Suffolk County, there's a lot of brutal activity and burglaries and not killings, but violence. And on the other hand, on Long Island, you know, the murder rate is down 30%. So, by the way, you can have crime rising without murder rising. It's not all about killing. But here's what I would say. Trump has a very simple culture war procedure in place, and the Democrats and the liberals are his foils, and it's very simple. He's Lucy Van Pelt, and he's got a cultural football, and he says, look, here's the NFL. Here's the MS-13 are animals. I'm terrible. I'm just the worst person in the world. Why don't you come and kick my culture war football and win the game? And they run up and he pulls it away from them and they fall down like Charlie Brown every single time. Now, I don't know how enduring it is. They fall for it. He's like, I'm going to call them animals. You're like, well, we can't call them animals. It's terrible. It's, you know, we're dehumanizing people. And then he says, I'm going to call them animals twice. Mm-hmm. I'm going to call them animals three times. What? You forgot about... The NFL comes out and says, Mr. President, we've come out with a new policy. It's really terrific. So we're going to tell them they can go into the locker room. If they kneel in front of the cameras, then they're going to get fined. But if they can go in the locker room, no one will see them kneel. It'll be nothing. And it's like, oh, this is great. Let me cue up that culture war football, buddy, because I am going to get them all. I'm going to get the Pavlovian response. Come kick it. And then he pulls it away from them. And then they're like, yeah. So their people say, oh, this is really terrible. It's awful and it's terrible. But in the end, it's like, what? You're not calling drug dealers animals? Animals is too good for them. Animals at least don't eat their own. They're worse than animals. Animals is a kindness, you know? And this is just going to go on forever until, and this is a social media thing, it's just a kind of gut instinct response. Trump said, and then it's like, what? You know, what? Oh my God. Now, I'm with you, Noah. I think this is very corrosive of civil propriety and keeping us a good common culture. But it appears that ship.
An unpopular thing to
but
say.
It appears that ship has sailed.
I would say common culture begins with common symbols, and the anthem and the flag are the common symbols, and it's the left that's out of tune.
I gotta go puke in the corner because this whole thing with everybody coming out and standing for the flag in football. So everybody did it at baseball, right? It was at baseball. There was no anthem at football games. From what I read, when the U.S. military began investing enormous sums of money in football advertising, it asked the NFL to start having an anthem where the football players would put their hands on their hearts in the 1990s. Mm. It's not an American tradition.
It's an advertising tradition. It makes it even more
the
appealing.
Trajectory of this is going to be now that because the... Sohrab, the human spirit yearns for self-expression, and I think you would agree with that. And so these football players are going to make it their mission to find some other way to protest.
Why wouldn't anybody?
Then Donald Trump is going to position against that and ends up winning the argument. So well, he has a better Sohrab argument agrees. Against this, but it is corrosive, as you say.
Okay, Sohrab agrees comedy. With you that Trump wins the argument. And I am not so sure that Trump wins the argument.
I think he has won the argument.
No, but I'm saying here's the thing. We may say Trump wins the argument because he makes the left expose itself as having foolish opinions about certain types of things that don't, you know, comport with a general American understanding of patriotism and all that. But if he just picks he spent the year 2017 picking fights. And it did not go well for him. And for the last 3 months, that has not been his game. For whatever reason, I mean, he's picking a fight with, you know, the deep state and with the FBI and all of that. But he is not picking fights with lower people on the totem pole in America than he. He's not picking fights with the military, with a military wife. He's not picking fights with a football player. That's good. That's been good for him. And I think this is a temptation for him. It's bad, maybe bad for liberals, but it may be worse for him.
I think it's actually completely visceral for him and emotional. And I don't think it's a matter of strategy at all. I think he has his hackles up about the NFL in a way that's just beyond my ability to sympathize with, and he cannot put together an imitation of graciousness at a moment like this and say, all right, well, I'm glad they came around. It's good. Everyone should stand for the anthem.
Yeah, this guy is so patriotic. He's so wonderfully loving of his country that he went on the Super Bowl with Bill O'Reilly and said that we're no better than Russia because we kill people too. That's the man who insists that everybody stand for our flag. Well, you know, I'm not going to take his babbitry at face value. That's nonsense. He's perfectly willing to deploy horrible anti-Americanism of its own in a visceral manner whenever he sees fit. Yeah. That was part of his campaign in 2015 and 2016.
I'm not even convinced that he wants to, you know, dig back into the culture war as a strategic matter either, in terms of, you know, as a way of ramping up for midterms. I think this is one of those things that it pushes his buttons and he's off to the races.
Ultimately,
when this
kind of conduct is so unsatisfying because it isn't politics. It's not activism. There's no legislative objective to achieve. There's no end game. No victory can be achieved here. It is all just positioning and anxiety. It's not as though this is the civil rights movement where we have some sort of a legislative objective that we're seeking to change. It's just positioning.
What do you
and
mean?
Barking.
You better, you have to stand for the anthem or you're going to get thrown out of this country. That is the legislative. I want the Freedom Caucus right now to be drafting that bill.
Both
because
sides of this.
Gall,
I mean,
darn it.
I don't know.
You better stand for that anthem.
I mean,
you
what's
know
the
what?
Other
if
side
you've
of
got
it?
A torn meniscus, you're standing for the anthem. Or you're getting put on that plane to Pyongyang.
I'm not exactly sure what Dante Stallworth hopes to achieve by sitting for the national anthem. What is the legislative aim that we are seeking to effect here?
I know.
The bottom line is it is all just positioning, and that's why everybody's so angry about it, because nothing will come of it.
Now, I don't think that's why everybody's angry about it. I think you, in your piece, The Fatalist Conceit, you lay out the ways in which this is depressing and sort of life-sucking for the people who fall prey to it. But it's also very seductive, and it has the advantage of being something that is easy rather than hard, right? Legislating is hard. Getting to yes is hard. Making compromise is hard. Yelling at people on Twitter is easy. Kneeling so that half the country supports you.
I don't
you
know, man. The ratio
is really
stinks.
Easy. The ratio.
Audience, have you been ratioed, man?
The ratio.
Burn.
Just to explain what the ratio is. So the ratio is there are, when you tweet something, after you tweet it, people either comment, people can like it. They can like it and comment on it, or they can just comment on it. If you see a tweet that's particularly controversial and it says something like this, there are 3 likes, which is a little heart, and 2,700 comments, you are
that's
in trouble.
A bad ratio.
You are in bad trouble. Whereas if you have like 50 comments and 2,000 likes, that's a good ratio. So watch the ratio, please. By the way, we're very pleased. Thank you very much. A lot of people were. We did this special podcast yesterday on the passing of Philip Roth and the meaning of Philip Roth. We've gotten a lot of very, very nice comments about it, personal and on social media. And just let me take a minute to ask you yet again to go to iTunes and leave a review, because once again, Jonah Goldberg is pretending that his Remnant podcast is more popular than this podcast, and I don't know where he gets that idea from, just from download numbers and reviews and comments. But you know, popularity is really in the eye of the beholder, so I don't accept this. I consider this fake news. Our crowd is much larger than Jonah's, our inaugural crowd, much larger than Jonah's inaugural crowd. And if you leave some comments, maybe you can provide some moderate factual support for this rather grand assertion that I'm making. But it's very important because he keeps acting so uppity, and I just, you know, can't let it stand. So for Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Saurabh Amari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.